You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Good morning and welcome to A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. On the other end, we have Matt.
Hello.
And Mago.
Hello.
And today we are discussing the works of Werner Herzog. He's done a lot of things in his career, but he's probably currently best known for his documentaries, although his style is a little bit subjective. So let's just give us a quick intro, guys. What do you think about Mr. Herzog's style of documentary filmmaking to start off with?
He has that guerrilla kind of style, which surprisingly doesn't get old. He said early on in an interview that the first thing he did was steal a camera from film school and then some rolls of film. He wanted to make absolutely sure that those rolls of film and the theft weren't wasted. So he wanted to do something very, very excellent, something very good. And he certainly tries to do something exceptional every time, even now that he's, I don't know, 80 or something. He's still out there doing stuff that nobody expects. I mean, you don't know what the next Werner Herzog movie is going to be like. And I'm not even mentioning his cameos in weird places.
I mean, I have to say that for me, I don't first think of Werner Herzog as a documentary maker, which is kind of weird because I think the first two or three films of his that I did see were documentaries. But I think for me, I very much think of basically his, shall we call it, twisted bromance with Klaus Kinski, the films he made in the 70s. I think probably because when I was growing up, I never saw any of the films, but they were constantly showing them on TV. So I think that's what I think of. And the second thing I think of, or perhaps even the first thing by now, is I just think of his voice. I think Werner Herzog has one of the most fascinating voices in the business. You wouldn't think that someone like that would actually get work also as a voice actor, but he does. And no one else sounds like him. You know, he's popped up in Miyazaki's The Wind Rises. And when he turned up, I just had to laugh and I had a big stupid grin on my face because, hey, it's Werner Herzog. Mm-hmm. But to get back to your question, the documentaries, the subjectivity, I mean, I like documentaries that acknowledge their subjectivity because I think objectivity is usually either a lie or, how should I put this? It's the filmmakers being mistaken if they think, hey, you can be objective. I think there's always going to be subjectivity and they like it when that is foregrounded. And with Herzog, that's very much the case. You would never mistake a Werner Herzog documentary for anyone else's documentary, not least because of the voice.
All right. So today we've all brought a film by Werner Herzog to discuss on this pod. So Matt, you go ahead. What did you bring us?
Of course, I'm the one who didn't bring a documentary. So, or is it? It's also, I cheated a bit. I mean, I've seen some Werner Herzog, but I don't know him enough to be an expert. Not at all. We had, I think, one or two of his films recorded for years, actually, by now, but we'd never watched them. And the one that I was curious about was Nosferatu from 79, which, of course, is a remake. I think it's probably Herzog's only remake. I don't really see him as much of a remake artist. He remade the, it's 1920s, right? German expressionist classic Nosferatu. Although, differently from that one, he could actually use the names of the book that they were ripping off. So this is actually about not Graf Orlok, but Count Dracula. You've got Jonathan Harker. You've got basically all the characters that you know from other Dracula adaptations. And it's a weird, weird film. I think after 10 minutes, I was ready to say it's a bad film. And I think at least one of you might also say it is a bad film. I think there's stuff in there that is strange in a way where I find it difficult to say, is this bad filmmaking or is this just so idiosyncratic that you can't tell the difference? There are scenes early on in, what's it called?
Wismar.
Wismar, exactly. There are scenes early on in Wismar that basically look like a 70s or 80s German TV soap opera. The music is the same thing. You've got this flat lightning. The music is dreadful. It's cheesy. The acting is wooden. I think by now that there's a, you know, I also thought at the time there's a purpose to it. I don't think that Herzog is a bad director, and I don't think he works with bad actors. I mean, you've got Bruno Ganz in this, and Bruno Ganz has never been a bad actor. But you start with this kind of bourgeois setting that is just bad and boring and flat and horrible. I think the music was the worst. The music was really the kind of German 70s Muzak.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, Jonathan Harker for work has to go to Transylvania, and the setting changes and the images change. You've got, I would say, not picturesque, wild nature, countryside. There is a real wildness to it. There's a real sense of danger to it. You get the impression this guy might actually just die on the way to Transylvania. He might just, you know, drop off the side of a mountain or fall into a, I don't know, a ravine or something. And it's, even though it's not a documentary, clearly not, there is an element, I think, there that reminds me of his documentaries, especially of his nature documentaries. It's this human being surrounded by nature, and nature does not care. There's danger even before the vampire appears. And funnily, when the vampire appears, he does not actually seem dangerous as such. He seems kind of pathetic. He seems sad and also kind of ridiculous. When you look at Klaus Kinski under the makeup, this kind of pale, hunched thing with the two front teeth that are sharp, it's not the kind of, you know, the elegant fangs of Christopher Lee or Gary Oldman. It's basically, he looks like a rabbit with dental problems, an albino hairless rabbit with dental problems. And it's also Klaus Kinski. I mean, Klaus Kinski is one of those actors who's usually intense and over the top. And I don't know, I think I read that somewhere that basically when Herzog directed him for Nosferatu, he always got the over the top take out of the way, made him really angry. And then he filmed one more take when Kinski was actually tired and could no longer do the over the top thing. And it kind of works. This is a Dracula who's not, he's not Gary Oldman, he's not sexy, he's not Christopher Lee, he's kind of a sad old guy. He's like your great granddad in an old people's home who just happens to like blood. And there is always an air of the ridiculous about the film, but I don't think that that actually harms the film, because there is still stuff going on that is kind of uncanny and difficult to, you know, you can't say, okay, this is supposed to be scary, this is supposed to be epic, this is supposed to be this or that. There's images later in the film, once Dracula is in Wismar, which are quite apocalyptic in a totally unique style for the movies, which remind me of, I don't know, the paintings of Breuil. I've probably totally mispronounced that, especially with a Dutch person on the podcast. Or Hieronymus Bosch. There's this sense of the world is ending, the plague has come, and everyone's basically already dead. It's just some people don't know it yet. And those moments I found really enjoyable. There's elements that I thought at first, this is horrible. For instance, Lucy Weston, who's basically, I would have expected her to be Mina Murray, but I think they basically compressed some characters there. At first, she's just played like a porcelain doll by Isabel Adjani. She's just pale and a non-entity. She's just there for the visuals. But then suddenly, because everyone else is basically sick or panicking or infected, she develops agency, and even though that agency ends up with her sacrificing herself, which is a problematic trope, you still get the impression that, you know, the character changes. The character does have some agency. So there's, for every moment where I think, what the hell, Herzog, what were you thinking? There's other moments where I think, this is unique and effective and original and totally unlike anything I've ever seen in another vampire film. What did you guys think?
I didn't like it at all. It falls flat off almost anything that Herzog stands for. There were moments where I thought, okay, now he's doing something, and then the moment was over. I remember that scene where we see Isabella Gianni's character sitting at the desk. We see her in the mirror, and then there are footsteps or something, and then the door opens and only the shadow comes in, which makes sense because you can't see a vampire in a mirror. And then the door closes again and you realize he's in the room. That was a fantastic scene. And then it was followed by another scene that I thought, ah. You said about the documentaries that Herzog is easily identifiable. With that one, with Nosferatu, Nah, I don't think you would guess that it's a Herzog, other than seeing Kinski. That might give you a hint. But other than that, it's sort of disjointed and not thought through mostly. It looks like they had to cut the budget in half a few days before filming began. And some of the actors are not comfortable in their scenes sometimes. You can see them struggling. Yeah, I think quality-wise, it's sort of it's sort of substandard. I don't know what happened exactly.
I will stand up in defense of this poor film because I think it could be argued that it is a great film in the sense that it is completely original. I know it's a direct remake of The Murnau, and I don't know if you guys have seen The Murnau, but that is pretty old-fashioned. So I think it could be argued that it's a great, great piece of art, but I don't think it registers right. Just like you two said, it just doesn't register. You're like, what am I watching here? This is so weird. And Kinski is a rodent. Mm-hmm. Looks like a rodent. Well, so does Orlok in The Murnau.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, let's be fair. And it seems to me to be a direct remake. And I don't get it why this was made at all, in a sense, because why would Herzog, you know, look towards as something that wonky and old to remake? That, I mean, the 22 Murnau is a classic, obviously, and everybody should see it. But it's a really difficult film to pull off, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I can absolutely understand disliking the film. I think I was on the fence myself, and then Stockholm Syndrome kicked in and I kind of started to enjoy it. But I would say that I found it very reminiscent of some of the early Herzog. I don't know, has either of you seen The Enigma of Caspar Hauser?
No.
Yes.
Herzog likes his outsiders. He likes his freaks. And he also likes using amateurs or people who are actually not very good actors. And I think he uses that to achieve a certain effect that sometimes works, sometimes doesn't work. But to go for something that isn't kind of, let's say, it's completely different from Hollywood. It's much closer probably to some other 70s filmmakers from Germany. I think, for instance, that Fassbinder and also Wim Wenders, they have this element sometimes where the acting can come across as almost amateurish, but it's because I think they are looking for a kind of authenticity, and that's a tricky word that could probably fuel several podcasts itself, but they're looking for a kind of authenticity that comes out of people who are not trained actors doing what they've been trained to do. And I think you see some of this in this film. There's some of these weird extras or small parts. They are also in some of the other films, and they are as weird and freakish in their way as Kinski is. Almost more so. It's like Kinski's basically a freak, but he's a figure of pathos and pity. And the bourgeoisie, they're also freaks, but because they're the bourgeoisie, no one notices, no one says anything because they're the mainstream. But as I said, you know, part of this is also me trying to find meaning, and why did Herzog do this? Why, oh, why, oh God, did he do this? And at the same time, am I projecting something into the film? It's quite possible.
It seemed to me when I was watching it that, you know, Herzog has that baseline where he says, do you have the guts to do this or do that? Go out and steal a camera, steal film, and then film something extraordinary. I don't find it much in a remake to start with, and I don't find it much in a movie that remakes a classic and does not improve on it. I mean, if somebody should be able to improve on anything, it should be Herzog, if he decides to do a remake at all. And no, I mean, if I think of Nosferatu, I don't think of Herzog, I think of the original. I should probably watch the Herzog Nosferatu again, but I wouldn't know how to sort of appreciate it more. It sort of, it falls flat in many ways for me, sorry.
You know, if you say sorry one more time, Herzog will appear at night and tell you what to do with that sorry.
How many times have I said sorry? I don't know.
And he won't show up in the mirror, guys. We also brought a more well, if you can say mainstream in the case of Herzog, but a more familiar film of his, MAGA. What did you bring us?
I brought Grizzly Man. I should probably warn everybody listening that there's a spoiler. It's not just about Timothy Treadwell and his life with grizzly bears in Alaska. It's also about Timothy Treadwell's death by grizzly bears in Alaska. Again, Herzog uses a very interesting outsider, a sort of an isolated guy who does not like society much, who might have a psychological condition. It's not entirely clear. I think Grizzly Man is a little bit special for Herzog because Herzog is able to use many excerpts from Treadwell's camera shots as well. Treadwell shot a lot of footage about himself among foxes, grizzly bears in Alaska. Herzog had access to 100 hours of footage done by Treadwell. And I think about half of Grizzly Man is about features Treadwell's footage. And then Herzog intercuts that with interviews with people who knew him, one former girlfriend, a coroner, helicopter pilots, especially the one who found him, people like that. I think it's a fantastic movie. It's very, very interesting. You start watching and you think, ah, all right, he's found some kind of environmentalist or some kind of biologist or even an ecologist, whatever. I don't think Treadwell is any of that. He just wants to sort of protect the bears. He wants to save the bears, not only from intruders, but also from park rangers in the end. Treadwell spent 13 Alaskan summers among the bears in the wild, and he is absolutely unafraid. He is very much different from me. I mean, if I see a bear, I run the other way. He talks to them, he speaks into the camera, turns their back on two bears that are sort of grazing in the background, sometimes lifting their heads towards him, and you don't know, are they going to charge, are they going to roar? He is unafraid. You don't know what happens next. When I watched it the first time, I was completely tense because the movie makes it clear very early on, Treadwell is going to die. Death by bear. And you don't know when exactly that scene is going to come. You know it's going to come. You don't know when, and you don't know in which form. And Herzog is able to sort of show him as an adventurer. I had some sort of admiration at the beginning of the movie. And then I realized there's something weird about him. He is out there and does not feel fear. There's something lacking. For that, I also had some kind of admiration. But then I realized someone said he wanted to become a bear. I'm not sure whether that's entirely true, but I couldn't forget that line. And if you watch the rest of the documentary like that, you sort of also have to think that maybe Treadwell had some kind of, I don't want to say a death wish, but he found it all right to go there again and again and again. And after 13 summers, you can't shake the idea that he couldn't have been surprised to have been killed by a bear, him and his girlfriend. So maybe he just, he was so much of an outsider, he wanted to stop being human and to become a bear. And that's just far, far out there. It's completely fascinating to watch him go from some kind of adventurer to a guy who wants to become a bear and just to spend the rest of his life there. He, in some footage, he talks to the camera and he's completely frantic. He's agitated. He repeats his words. At some point, he talks like a child to a fox or to a bear. That was really, I'm really, really impressed by Grizzly Man. I don't know. Am I the only one swooning about that movie, or did you find?
No, you're not. I think it's a fantastic, fantastic film. Mm. I think also Treadwell seems to be an activist without a cause, right? because he's so radical about a danger that may not exist, mm-hmm. even. And that's made very clear in the movie. So the tragedy, I think, is that he lost his life for a cause that he felt very deeply, but which may not actually have existed.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes the movie extremely poignant to me still. And I've seen it more than, a lot of times,
mm-hmm.
right? And it doesn't lose its poignancy because Treadwell is a fantastic filmmaker, I think, in his own right. The stuff that you get to see on screen is magic. It really is. Yeah. So I don't think it gets old, even.
Thank you for saying that he doesn't have a cause. I never saw it that way, but it's sort of... Well, he does a cause, but it could be an imaginary one. That's a very good point. Thanks. Yeah, I mean, if you look at the facts of the movie, there are some... What do they say? 35,000 bears in Alaska, and... Treadwell wants to save them. Good luck. I mean, I would really love to know whether he showed any of the footage to the park rangers. You know, he has that 5-minute rant where he sort of gives them the finger and uses expletives and everything. Why? I mean, they could be on his side. Why not try and collaborate? Why antagonize them? He's out there very, very angry sometimes. Mm-hmm. And at other moments, he's very, very childlike, and he could be talking to a teddy bear or anything.
I think Herzog probably relates to that anger exactly. I mean, he can sometimes be very angry as well. But what I still find very strange and intriguing about this film is I think Treadwell is both something that Herzog abhors, that he despises, and that he loves. I think Herzog has been very explicit about hating the sentimentalization mm-hmm. of nature and sentimentality in general. He hates those things. He finds them phony. He finds them useless, and he finds them hypocritical.
Mm-hmm.
And Treadwell absolutely sentimentalizes the bears. He wants to be a bear himself, but basically he thinks the bears are human beings. He's basically, as you said, he's like a child with this kind of magic idea of the bears. It's like, if you saw the world through his eyes, the world would be a cartoon. It would be Care Bears or something, not, you know, feed mm-hmm. on human being bears. But at the same time, Treadwell is exactly the kind of outsider, as you said. He's a freak. He's abnormal in one sense or another. And I think that's something that Herzog loves. He loves that intensity. He loves that earnestness that is there. And I think that tension for me is one of the things that makes the film absolutely fascinating. I don't think I've ever read anything bad about it. I think it's probably one of Herzog's most beloved films. And for me, I think it is partly that tension that is one of the reasons why it's such a good film.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think this comes from another of his films, but there's this quote that he did about the harmony of nature, where he says the harmony of overwhelming and collective murder. This is how he sees nature. He's not, you know, in his work, nature is the boogeyman, basically. And this is not just Grizzly Man. This is a recurring theme that I see in a lot of his movies, even his older ones, Fitzcarraldo and Aguirre.
Mm-hmm.
Where nature is really this vile, obscene thing, right?
Yeah.
And you see that in Grizzly Man too. So the juxtaposition of Herzog's views on nature and Treadwell's views on nature is also very interesting to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't know whether he does that often in his documentaries, but in Grizzly Man, he sort of dissociates himself twice from his subject. Treadwell says something about nature and love and harmony and everything. And then there's a cold shower by Herzog's distinct voice saying, "I believe that the common denominator of the universe is not harmony, but chaos, hostility, and murder." Sorry for the incomplete impersonation. But that's sort of where Herzog sort of puts his, you know, wooden stake in, so to speak. He takes himself back for some of the time because he can just let Treadwell's footage roll. That footage does the job for him. There's some kind of voiceover. And then Treadwell says something about harmony in nature and love and bears. And then Herzog, bam, that's it. I think not, you know. And you realize, as fascinating as he finds his subject sometimes, he still has to take a stance. When he doesn't like something, he gets really rather expressive, Mr. Herzog does.
Oh yeah, definitely.
I think that's also a trait in him. I mean, there are reports about him where he had to sit on a panel or in a jury for a movie festival, and people were going on about cinema vérité and auteur and all that. And he says, nah, doesn't work. According to himself, he always says, Merry Christmas, losers, or something like that. And then he leaves. I don't know whether that's true or his fabrication, but he doesn't put up with stuff. I mean, at some point, he just says his opinion, and sometimes it's outrageous. Sometimes it's true, sometimes it's ludicrous, but you can't get it out of your head. For instance, he says that there is no other bottomless stupidity in whole of nature than if you look in the eyes of a chicken. needless to say, he absolutely loathes vegetarians. You know, when you're invited by Werner Herzog to lunch or dinner, there's going to be meat because, you know, that's the food chain, basically.
Which I think in some ways ties back to the thing about nature. I mean, I would absolutely agree with you, Julie, and back at that, he doesn't see nature as something pretty. Absolutely not. Mm. I do think he sees a beauty in nature, but that's distinctly different from pretty. I think you see that in the filmmaking itself. He's fascinated by it. He absolutely sees it as, you know, something beautiful, but it's a frightening beauty, I think, because it doesn't care. It doesn't care at all. And why should it care? You know, if anything, we project that it cares. But nature is not our mother. It's basically the thing that's going to have us for lunch.
Yeah. No, I think Herzog also knows what he can do to an audience and what he can't with nature and hostility and murder and everything. A lesser movie would have maybe used the tape that audibly records Treadwell's death and his girlfriend's, Amy Huguenard's, death. But Herzog doesn't want to do that. He is outspoken. He says what he thinks, but there's a limit to what he wants to do to an audience. He wants to dazzle the audience. He wants to make his stuff interesting. He sometimes sort of manipulates his own documentaries, but he knows when to stop. And I can't think of any documentary filmmaker who doesn't know how to stop that goes too far. But Herzog has some kind of moral code, definitely. Even if it's nobody else's but his own. I don't know. Do you see it like that as well?
He's definitely has his own. I don't know if it's a moral code, but he has he is his own person. I don't think he's ever compromised on a film. I don't think he would ever compromise on a film. He has strong views, strong opinions, and he doesn't go in for fakery. I mean, you get a very real sense that when he refuses to play the tape of Treadwell and Huguenard's death, that he means it. This is not some sort of, you know, just for the audience. I think he really means that the tape should be destroyed. So yeah, he mm-hmm. certainly has strong views, and he is very much his own filmmaker. And I don't think he would ever compromise on that. Although ethics, if you look at his work in The Jungle, for instance, I have wondered often whether that is very ethical, what he's doing there. So he says strong views, let's put it that way.
I mean, the thing about ethics and definitely nature, I mean, I've read horrible, horrible things about the thousands and thousands of rats that he used for Nosferatu, that basically, I think half of them already died on the journey to where they were filming, eating each other, which itself sounds like a Herzog film. And then I think he had them all dyed the right color, and dyed is the right word, because I think they dunked them into pretty much boiling dye, and that killed off another half of the rats. So I don't want to know how many rats there were to begin with, because even like this, it sometimes feels like there's tens of thousands of rats on the screen. Again, he doesn't sentimentalize, and I think that translates into a certain ruthlessness. But I think it is part of his personal ethics, which I think is probably entirely intuitive. He strikes me as someone who does not intellectualize his work or cinema in general. I think he's got opinions that very much come from his gut. Mm-hmm. And because of that, also, I think he's probably He must be the most fascinating and the most frustrating person to talk to about his opinions, because they are set in stone. They're going to be around way after all of us are dead. You know, in 20,000 years, when the aliens find this shell of a planet, they will find Herzog's opinions about chickens and nature kind of chiseled into the side of a mountain.
All right. I also brought you guys a film. It's also about outsiders. Werner Herzog went to Antarctica to make a film that was not about penguins. He's very clear on that point. He was not going to make another movie about penguins. What it turns out being is it's a movie about the people who inhabit this place, right? And it feels like somebody shook the world a little bit, and all the outsiders and people who are somehow displaced sort of sauntered down and ended up in this little bowl in Antarctica. So the people that you meet are extremely eccentric, extremely compelling, but also, well, quite weird sometimes. There's a very fabulous professor who walks around in tweeds and this school scarf. There is a linguist who, for some reason, is tending plants in Antarctica where there's no language. There's a gentleman who apparently has royal blood in him, who now works as, I think, a welder. So it's a quite a recent film. It's a fascinating piece of work. And yes, there will be penguins. I promise you, if you see this film, even though he insists it's not going to be about penguins, there are penguins, there are seals in it. So I wonder, you guys, how did you feel about the film?
I liked it a lot. I watched it yesterday. I didn't know what to expect. And when 2 minutes into the film, you see a kind of drawing of a chimpanzee riding a goat, I thought, yep, we're in Herzog country. I did also wonder at times. I mean, I think it's a fascinating film. I think it's absolutely, you know, imaginative. And it's got some of those statements that only Herzog could make, like when he talks about abominations such as an aerobic studio and yoga classes. That's the kind of sentence that only Herzog would speak out. I was also wondering at times, I mean, I mentioned the voice before and the things he says. If you had just the images and not Werner Herzog's voiceover, would you still be able to tell that it's a Herzog documentary? I think that it is so much in what he says about these things, the kind of angle that he presents on it. But I don't know, do you think a Herzog documentary is identifiable just visually?
I do. There's no doubt in my mind. Maybe not this particular one, even though you could probably tell by the kind of characters that he puts in this film and the way this is not a BBC Life, one of those beautifully produced David Attenborough documentaries, right? It gets pretty ugly and pretty silly. And I think if you turn the sound off, you would still be able to tell. And I think that's the way with lots of his films. I mean, Woodcarver, Steiner, or Fata Morgana, even the earlier ones. I think you could, even though they're pretty mainstream, I think you could turn the sound off and just know. Because it's about these people, these characters. I mean, how does he find these people? They're amazing, but they are definitely offbeat. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Michael, what do you think?
I'm not sure whether Encounters at the End of the World is easily identifiable as a Herzog. I mean, he went there because the one of the divers or the underwater cameraman was his friend and brought back some underwater footage, and Herzog found it absolutely stunning. You know, it's nature but dangerous, so that's right up his street, and then he went there and filmed it. There is one scene where three scientists put their ears on the ice in order to listen better to the sounds of the animals underneath the ice. And that's a scene where Herzog said, "Would you do that for me?" He set them up to do it. I mean, if you put your ear to the ice, it's going to stick there. Danger. So no scientist in their right mind would do that.
Exactly. Few people know it, but they're still there, stuck to the ice. They feed them on a daily basis.
Maybe we're going to find them in 50 years, you know. Yeah. maybe it's maybe Herzog is also the only one who is hell-bent on filming that, what is it, that fish that hangs the sturgeon at the absolute south, at the mathematical south pole or whatever that is. You know, there's a fish and there are flowers and a poem, but it's basically the fish he's interested in and things like that. That's also a Herzog scene. But I'm not sure whether I would recognize it. It is really his distinct voice that makes it a Herzog. By the way, a little anecdote. Did you hear about the Simpsons thing he did? Matt Groening or someone from his team phoned Mr. Herzog up and said, we would like you to participate in the comic, The Simpsons. Maybe you know them. And he said, no, I don't know The Simpsons, but if you want my voice for it, fine, I'll do it. And then he hung up and then he realized, it's weird. Comics, you know, why do they need my voice? I mean, they're in print, they're in newspapers, they are, you know. He didn't know that The Simpsons was an animated show on TV.
I mean, he has that. He's going to appear in that Star Wars series on the new Disney Plus streaming service, The Mandalorian. I think he's the best thing about the trailer. And he's never watched a single Star Wars film. He just read the script and thought, yeah, okay, I can do that. I mean, he doesn't know The Simpsons and Star Wars. Obviously, Werner Herzog.
Well, it's probably too cinema verite for him.
Yeah, he's really a sort of what the heck kind of person. And I think you can tell by his films and the themes that he uses, like obsession and man against nature, that sort of thing. He's aware, very sort of, well, what the hell, let's do it sort of type of director.
Mm-hmm.
So I think more generally, apart from being able to identify Herzog films with the sound of, generally what sort of themes could you say, okay, this is totally Herzog movie? Amaga?
Man against nature, against all odds. I mean, dragging a ship through the rainforest. he loves outsiders. The weirder, the more cinematic, the better. And of course, if you try to fight nature as much as you can, you will eventually get to be an outsider. Everybody is very concerned with saving nature. Nobody is concerned with fighting nature. And that's the fight of one solitary person. That's Herzog territory. I think these are the two big themes that he uses a lot.
Yeah.
For me, it's two things, perhaps. I mean, we've already talked about some of them, the kind of freaks that he loves. I think Herzog loves making things strange. He's got a keen sense for the ridiculous. I think he always makes us look at things through different eyes. You know, the penguins, we're not looking at them as our cute, fluffy little penguins, but something else, the drama that's going on underneath. So I think he makes things strange in how he observes them, and he makes them strange for us. And I think Herzog, he's something of an ethnographer. I think he looks at cultures and individuals, and the combination of those two things, looking at these cultures and these individuals, but making us seeing them differently, I think is supposed to bring out some kind of truth that we don't just, you know, see what we always see. You know, we see some, I don't know, natives out in the jungle, and of course we think National Geographic, and then Herzog comes and he makes us see something else. He makes us see something playful, something tragic, something absurd. I think that's really what Herzog is for me. He's an ethnographer with a keen sense of the ridiculous and the sublime.
And for me, the obsessed. All these people that he talks about and talks to are driven. They are driven by something. I mean, again, Woodcarver Steiner, he's a ski flyer, and he keeps overshooting the mark. He goes so far that he overshoots the mark. And the whole film is about this guy who just wants to jump really, really far on his skis.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating because this dude is fascinating. And in his fictional films, like the most sort of famous Fitzcarraldo and Aguirre, are also about men who are obsessed and driven. And I think this is Herzog's projection on his characters, because I think he is a man who is so driven as to border on obsessive in his work. I don't know, that would be my sense of his filmography in general.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But what I find fascinating is, I mean, totally agree with you, but if you think about all these things, outsiders, freaks, obsession, man versus nature, you'd think he was kind of po-faced. But I think he's also got a sense of fun. I think you can always laugh when you watch one of his films. And that is so rare. I think it's really rare that you get someone who deals with themes like this, and he's totally aware of the ridiculousness of his subjects and himself. And that's weirdly lovable.
Mm-hmm. I think he is very aware of the ridiculousness of many of his subjects, but he does not ridiculize them. He knows the difference. As soon as he sees something ridiculous or laughable, he is interested, but he does not join the choir. He sort of takes another stance. Mm-hmm. He sort of makes the ridiculousness the serious topic, if you like. He positions himself clearly to Treadwell. He says in the movie twice that he is not of Treadwell's opinion. All the rest of it, he sort of looks at Treadwell as a very interesting subject. He sympathizes with him, except for these two moments. And that's a clear position, and it doesn't involve ridiculizing or even talking down to your subject,
mm-hmm.
especially when the subject can no longer reply.
Okay, I think that's time, guys. I had a blast. I want to thank our listeners for joining us on A Damn Fine Cup of Culture, and we hope to see you next time. Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.